In a world of expanding technology and growing cynicism, there is still a growing demand for magic and illusionists. We know these are illusions, sleight of hand, but we're still pulled in. Look at the proof. Tourists on the Las Vegas Strip can choose from numerous magic acts. What makes some illusionists better than others may come down to innovation and daring. With technology constantly altering our view of life and the consistent theft of magic tricks underneath as well, how is an illusionist to make a living and even to prosper? Joining us now is Murray Sawchuk. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here, and good morning to you.
You've been headlining now for 2 years.
I have, yeah.
If somebody dreamed of seeing their name in lights on the Strip, what should they do? I mean, how is this different from other towns?
It's interesting. You know, I'm originally from Vancouver, Canada, and BC, and you see stuff on TV when you're younger growing up, and you go, how do they get there? And I think you see opportunities, and I think the key is to just say yes, you know, because you can always go back to what you had, you know, And I think when you do say yes, a lot of opportunities come your way. And you always say no later. But if you say no right away, you've cut yourself off. And if you say yes, you can go for it. Mm. And I've been very fortunate. So it's been 2 years in Vegas. It's like a lifetime.
No. I'll bet you've also had to say yes to some really strange places and opportunities early in your career, at least.
Sure.
So what's it like here compared to, let's say, people on a cruise ship, people at a party, and things like that? How does Las Vegas crowd compare?
Different, too, when you're in Vegas versus like a cruise ship or a resort overseas. You know, when you're in a resort in Asia or Europe or you're on a cruise ship, you know, a cruise ship's a forced environment. They're coming to see you on a cruise ship because they have nothing else to do in that hour and a half. And it's paid, and it's actually, you know, part of their itinerary. And they don't know even who the heck they're seeing until they're on board the ship, unless it's a specialty cruise or it's a jazz cruise or it's one of those Star Wars cruises and they're all on it or something. But other than that, you know, they don't know until they're in that theater. And it's lovely that you have a audience of 1,800 people, but they don't know who the heck you are until they're sitting down. Whereas in Vegas, you have to sell tickets on your own name and getting out there and the exposure. So it's a lot different in the sense of why people are sitting in the audience. You know, it's neat in Vegas when I walk out on stage, people know who I am before I get on stage. If I'm working a cruise ship or a resort in Europe or Asia like I did years ago, they're not quite sure who they're seeing until I'm on stage. So it's kind of like gaining fans after the show, not before. So it's very interesting.
Does being from Vancouver have a little bit of a built-in help as far as marketing is concerned? I mean, I'm thinking of Celine Dion. Mm. You know, 40% of Quebec over the years must have come out to Las Vegas to see her.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, does that help with other Canadian performers?
It's interesting, though, because, you know, when you're in Canada, and I love Canada to death, and it is, you know, I'm a dual citizen in both countries, but, you know, when you're in Canada trying to make it, it's hard to get any grip because it's a smaller country. You know, we got, about 46 million in Canada, which is the size of California's population, and that's in the whole country. And so it's hard to get any traction, get a lot of people supporting you. But it is funny, once you've gone to the States and you've made it, you know, once you're Jim Carrey, once you're Celine Dion, once you're Leslie Nielsen and Nelly Furtado and Pamela Anderson, the list goes on. Once you're famous, now Canada goes, hey, you're Canadian. Hey, you are Canadian. And now you're Canadian, and we love you.
Now we embrace you.
Now we'll embrace you, and you're ours. But when you're trying to pay the bills and you're trying to get people in the show, it's very hard to get traction. So it's very interesting. After you've gone away to make it, now they're like, hey, you can come back now because we like you, and we'll buy a ticket, and you are Canadian now. Now you're Canadian. Before you weren't, but now you're
Now you are.
Yeah. But I love Canada, but it's the way like that is in a lot of places. I think a lot of people got to leave their hometown to go to New York, go to Chicago, go to L.A., or wherever they have to go to make it, then come back, and then you're appreciated a little bit more. So, you know, that's the way it goes.
Now, when it comes to comedy and comedians, we hear about the way comedians are constantly changing shows, keeping things kind of fresh, always looking for a better way to entertain. How much does your show need to change to stay fresh?
You know, when you're in Vegas and people come see your show every day, you don't need to change it as much as if you're touring every year into the same cities. You know, when you're a singer and you tour, usually you tour after an album's been released with a new song. You sing some of the old ones, but you sing the new album that's out. With magic in Vegas, because, you know, I do my show five nights a week here in Vegas, I keep the show pretty consistent, and then I'll change 5 minutes of it, or 10, or 15, and I'll switch out. And people who do come back after you, they go, oh my God, half the show's changed. I don't realize it because I'm putting in a new bit, or I'm changing it, or something became funny on the way to work, and I go, you know what, let's drop this in, this might work. So it is evolving, and I have over 2-3 hours of material I can drop in my show, but I generally, my show's an hour in 5, an hour, and 10 minutes because, you know, in a casino, you want to come in, see a show, and then you want to send the people back out of the casino because that's what they're here for, you know.
When you're doing tricks or you're adding, as you say, maybe 5 minutes, a different 5 minutes, what kinds of things do you look at refreshing? I mean, what do you take out? What do you put in?
You know, that's a good question. You know, I try to, you know, my show is so comedy-based. It's 80% comedy now. So I still try to keep a lot of the magic content in because people still come to see my show for the magic. And, you know, on TV, they see me vanish trains or Ferraris or, you know, produce bears and stuff. And when they come, I had a very funny thing happen a couple of weeks ago. A lady was very upset because she did not see me turn a girl into a tiger and produce my train. Well, the train would be the size of the room I'm in. You know, I am in the comedy club at the Laugh Factory, so it's 320 seats. But she was very upset, and she wanted a refund. And I said, well, I apologize. I said, but, you know, when you sat down in that room, you should have realized that there was no train. I can't even get a bicycle on the stage, let's be honest. But I thought it was very funny. I don't know if she wanted a refund or what the case was, but it was very funny, and we all had a nice laugh at it. And they just said, go down to the box office, get a refund if you'd like, you know, since there's no train, you know. But we always show the preview videos ahead of time, so legally, you did see me vanish a train, just not. You know.
Yeah, so, when you talk about trains and such, how tough is it to do a trick on television?
It's tough.
Compared to a live audience.
It's tough. You know, when you do something on TV, I just shot some stuff in L.A. yesterday, and most of the time when you're doing, for me, when I do live TV, a lot of it's not to tape, it's live. And when I get interviewed, most of the time, not like an actor where you can sit there and go, oh, I'm good looking, I got this brand new movie coming out, life's great, and you just sit there, look good, and talk. You can enjoy that. When I come on a show, I got to look decent, talk, dress the part, hopefully be entertaining, and then generally, it's like Inspector Gadget, I usually got to come with a trick. And so now I'm also not worried about just presenting myself well. I got to now perform and do the trick well, because you get one shot, and you don't want to mess up on live TV. Mm-hmm. But after you've been doing that for so long, it's kind of one of those things where you do get used to it, and you just go for it, and it's a good thing.
We're talking with illusionist comedian and Las Vegas headliner Murray Sawchuk. Murray Sawchuk just finished his second year headlining at the new Tropicana Hotel and Casino. Now, you've been here before, and we talked last time you were here about the idea of magicians stealing the work of other magicians, and we looked into the whole idea of copywriting and trademarking tricks. Help us understand a little bit about property rights in your world. Do you own the rights to a trick, or is it something that other magicians can repeat?
You don't really own the rights to any trick. You just hope that you're well-known enough or you've done it enough that you have a brand and you have it stuck with your name, you know. And if you're at a certain level in magic, you have a certain couth that you kind of stand back and you don't take other people's tricks. You know, I know Teller from Penn & Teller's won a lawsuit about a trick of his, and you can. If you have enough proof and somebody steals it verbatim, you can. Or if you do have a patent on it, you know. Or you can copyright your trick as a play. You can do that. And if anyone steals a section of the play, then therefore they've stolen the copyright. I have a couple things copywritten. But
yeah.
You can't really patent an idea of a magic trick because there's many different ways to do something. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So it's very hard. You just need to change one thing and it changes everything. But you can copyright a play. And if anyone steals a section of the play, therefore now you have the right to. And that's kind of the way, at least that's the way I've done it.
Well, generations ago, did say, Houdini ever worry about or care about people trying his stunts and tricks?
He was worried. Well, his big thing is he debunked a lot of mediums, spirits, in the early 1900s. I mean, his predecessors were Keller and Thurston and that, and he went up against them. And, you know, he was a number one promoter of publicity. And there was a point in his career where he wanted to start debunking spirits. He tried to be a medium for a while, and then he realized he wanted to disprove a lot of the people who were saying they really had the power. And he'd actually disguise himself, go into a theater, watch them perform, and then halfway through the show, he'd actually jump out of the theater and walk up on stage and disclose how it was all done. So he was really causing a lot of stir that way, but he got a lot of press and a lot of PR out of it. You know,
messing with people's livelihoods.
Well, that too, exactly. So he was extremely aggressive, but he knew how to get a name for himself, which he did, and he also knew how to get the exposure.
So, speaking of putting other people's livelihoods at risk, it's an era of YouTube, which surely was not around when Houdini was or many other early magicians. Online video streaming, social media, that's got to be a double-edged sword for people who do what you do.
Yeah, it is. It's a catch-22, you know, because magic never looks as good on TV as it does live because it's TV. It's flat. It's right there in front of you. And people always think there's some editing going on now. And with the editing programs now, with Photoshop, people can do it at home if they want. So now the indirect thing is people still go to Universal Studios and see Jaws attack them and see it rain and see an earthquake and see how a house catches on fire. And we watch St. Elmo's fire. We still cry when the building's on fire. So people still go to Universal Studios, see how the magic's done on the movies, and then the next weekend they go to a movie at the theater and cry and be sad and depressed or excited with the same effects they were just told how they were done. So indirectly, if you see YouTube stuff, there's still that market for live magic because people still want to go and see it for their own eyes going, okay, let's just check this out in real time to see if it's as good as we see on TV or if it's, you know, we can be fooled.
Well, I remember generations ago, Jack Benny said that the problem with television was that everybody around the country would see what you were doing, you know, the humor that you were putting out, what you were up to. Whereas in the days of vaudeville, you could take the same few jokes all across the country, and for everybody, it was fresh.
Yes.
With TV, you do one show, and suddenly the next week, you got to come up with something new.
That is scary. It's interesting for Jack Benny to say that because it's true. And he came into that TV era when it was all starting, wasn't he? And that must have been a big threat. Same with what's going on with the YouTube era and everything. It's a wonderful marketing tool, but it also is – it's also making – entertainers, what I've noticed, I did a couple of TV shows recently with a lot of younger magicians, and they're the YouTube generation of magicians. And they're the David Blaine magicians, or the ones that did the street stuff. And it's interesting because a lot of them have no idea how to walk on a stage or how to present themselves as a star on stage. And that first 15 seconds when you walk on stage is what really keeps you on stage and makes you a star. You watch Wayne Newton or any of those people walk on stage. They know how to walk on stage.
How do you learn that element of stagecraft? How did you learn it?
I think you just do it over and over. You learn what works, and then you mimic people. You watch the greats. You watch Phyllis Diller's. You watch Don Rickles. You watch Jerry Lewis. You watch the Wayne Newtons. You watch Dean Martins, how they'd enter a stage, and you start mimicking because they knew how to do it. They knew how to get the maximum applause. Because at the end of the day, as an entertainer back in the day, even if the booker didn't like you, if the audience loved you and they heard the applause from the back office in the theater, they went, you know what, we're booking him again. I mean, I like the guy, but he's selling tickets. Somehow they're clapping for him. And that was a technique you learned to walk on stage and make the audience love you. And I think that's the element with this YouTube generation they're missing. It's the same thing with communication. We can talk about that forever. With kids in school, they have no idea how to greet a person anymore or go to a party. They know how to text somebody and how to say hi, but there's no charisma. I think it's going to be one of these, in the next 20 years, people are going to lose the edge of charm and sophistication on how to greet and meet somebody. You know, so it's interesting.
We're talking with illusionist, comedian, and Las Vegas headliner Murray Sawchuk. It's the second year. He's finishing the second year, I should say, headlining at New Tropicana Hotel and Casino. Talk a little bit about the personalities of magicians kind of over over the years. David Blaine's kind of, you know, maybe a little bit bland. Chris Angel's got sort of the edgy street magician kind of look.
Yeah.
You know, your personalities, you're different from Harry Blackstone Jr., let's say.
Yes, of course.
How have personalities of magicians and performers who do magic incorporated into their acts changed over the last generation, say?
I think there's a lot. I think it's all depending how you want to sell yourself. You know, I did serious magic in my early 20s. I became world champion, won over 24 awards and all this stuff for doing serious sleight of hand and magic. And it was lovely, but I watched on TV that comedians and people with personalities got further. I mean, people don't realize Steve Martin and Bob Barker and Johnny Carson were all magicians before they did what they did. And the reason they're doing and they became famous for what they did is because they became personalities, not just magicians. And for me, that's the sign I saw. I want to become more of a personality, not just a magician. Whereas Dave Blaine is a magician. That's what he does. Uri Geller is a medium, is a magician, is someone that can bend spoons and play with the mind and all that stuff. So certain people go a different direction. I found myself when I started doing serious magic, as I was doing serious magic, thought about myself in the audience going, I wouldn't even believe this crap. I mean, come on now. So I actually said what I was thinking on stage, and people laughed because they're like, oh, my God, he's just like our next-door neighbor. He's us. And that's where I found I connected with the audience. And when I walk on stage now, people know I'm just having a good time. I don't have some special power. It's just something I've studied and designed, and it's just a good time for an hour and a half. And I think at the end of the day, people get that. And people who don't like magic actually still enjoy my show. So.
Many years ago, a lot of the action on the Strip was kind of on the northern end. Parts are on Sahara Avenue and such, and now it seems it's kind of come back to the middle between, well, actually south maybe, between Flamingo and Tropicana. Mm. That may be changing. The SLS is going to be opening soon, and the eventual Genting project is with the old Echelon stands is going to open as well. Is the energy moving back toward the northern end of the Strip?
I think it might be. It's funny that you brought that up because I was talking about the SLS, and, you know, I was watching how they were building their hotel, and then I also compared it with what they were doing at the Quad. And I love what they did at the Link. The Link's amazing with the whole Ferris wheel and the wheel, the high roller and everything else, and that street that did such a phenomenal job. And then, like, the Imperial Palace, they kind of basically put a couple of facades on it, but if you look at the back end, it still has the Chinese design. It's really poorly done compared to the street and the Ferris wheel, and they kind of changed it, but they haven't really. Then I looked at the Sahara and I go, oh my God, is SLS going to do the same thing? Put up a little paint, a little spray paint, put a little corner and a molding, and they go, oh, it's a new hotel. And I got to be honest with you, I'm watching how they're building it. It looks phenomenal. They've kept the structure, but they've taken the walls out. They got some floor-to-ceiling glass on the front so you can see all of the westerly side, and I'm sure it's the easterly side as well, but at least coming down Sahara at the Strip, I could see that side. And I think they're doing a really amazing job of it. And it's very Beverly Hills looking, which is their idea. Having Fred Siegel and, of course, the Griddle and all those, you know, LA type of stores and restaurants there. And I think either the first 3 months is going to be phenomenal. We'll all be there. And I think after the first 3 months, that will stand the test of time, whether it's going to be the Hang or it's going to be a fun thing for 3 months and people are going to start going back down to the south end of the Strip. But I think with the Genting project, and I've been to Genting and I've been overseas, and if they come in with the strength they have overseas, that is going to be a massive project that's going to compete with the Cosmo, Aria, a Mandarin complex. I think it's going to be a much more fun area, much more old Vegas. I think it's going to be bright colors, a lot more not as serious Vegas, whereas I think the Cosmo and Aria is much more something you'd see in Chicago. You know what I mean? Much kind of serious, very business-like Vegas, where I think this end is going to start to become a little more fun again. And I think that's where we're going to see the maybe Circus and the Riviera starting to go down, and I think maybe it's a whole change for that end. That could be the swoop of everything.
So you think they've got a shot at really changing the balance?
I think they do. And, you know, look at that one hotel. It could have been amazing. Wasn't it the Fountain Blue they were going to do?
Right,
the Fountain Blue. It's 78% done. So close. And it was going to be a gorgeous-looking hotel. You could see the blue tint in the windows, and I couldn't imagine the day when they realized we're going to pull the plug. It's so close. And that, I presume, probably will come along, too, because it's got the structure still, and it's ready to go, you know.
One more thing I've got to ask you about. I think you're in one of the videos, the TSA videos at McCarran.
Yes, I am.
Just, sort of helping everybody get through the lines.
Yeah.
And so on and so. What was that process like?
My publicist, Cheryl Kagan, who is amazing. She's been with me for most of my career. And she got the call and she said, hey, guess what? They're interested in using you for the TSA videos. Now, when I arrived in Vegas, 12 years ago, I remember seeing Lance Burton and Wayne Newton and all those Care Top and Rita Rudner and the list goes on. I thought, man, that's so cool that they have the stars of Vegas, in these videos. What an entertaining way. It's only Vegas could do, because no other TSA in the world has that. And it was a cool thing. And, of course, I fly a lot, so you see them all the time. And I go, wow, what a cool opportunity. You've really made it in Vegas when you're on one of these. Well, sure enough, they call me. And I thought, out of all the magicians, they called me to come do this. And I said, yeah, of course I'm going to. To me, it's a huge thing. Other places in the world, if they've never been to Vegas, you don't know what it is. But when you are here, it is kind of a part of Vegas that only is Vegas. And so I said, of course, let's do it. And they pitched the idea to me about this guy and going through TSA and you got to take all your clothes and jewelry off. And then I help the guy and I magically take his toupee off and I try to put it back on without him knowing. It's a very funny bit. And we all have our own little sections. Carrot Top has his and Rock Vault has theirs. So I was honored to do it, and it's funny now everyone takes pictures of the video screens and sends it to me as if I didn't know I did it. Oh my God, guess what, you're doing this. And I'm like, yeah, I was there. I'm not going to go through a TSA thing in an electric blue suit with Chloe, my assistant and wife, in a pink dress and my lefty stagehand and, of course, an overalls and a hat. But it is funny now when I go through TSA, I get through a lot quicker because they go, oh, we've seen you. You've got the drill down. So I still get inspected very well, but they know I know the drill. So.
You get into the fast line.
Exactly.
That's a great benefit.
I know. So it was really an honor to do that because I see a lot of stars growing up there and kind of cool to be part of Vegas that way, So
Murray, it's been great having you back. Thanks
for having me on. I appreciate it.